The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Hidden History is the secondary theme for April and explores the little things that shape our state. Lost arts, forgotten places, and stories not often told. With 8 articles, I'll do my best to cover as many of them as possible. As there are 5 episodes for April, I think we'll get to most of them. The first article is A Window to the Past. In Raleigh, the Museum of History houses the artifacts and anecdotes that trace North Carolina's journey from past to present. Now, a pair of virtual programs open the museum to people across the state and around the world, uncovering hidden aspects of our history, one bite-sized piece at a time. Growing up in Pinehurst, siblings Andrew Sobiero and Suzanne Newman knew about the lectures on complex medical topics that their father gave to fellow practitioners, but they never got to see him deliver a full program for his peers. So when Dr. Michael Sobiero was scheduled to give a talk at the North Carolina Museum of History, they were not about to let the fact that they both live hundreds of miles away stop them from attending. Just before noon on January 10th, with Andrew in New York City and Suzanne in Atlanta, they clicked a link and found themselves transported to the downtown Raleigh Museum, whisked through the tall glass doors and under the replica Wright glider to a front row seat in the auditorium where their dad enthralled his audience with the intersection of history and medicine. I'm usually too busy to do something like this during the workday, but I was not going to miss it, says Suzanne, who eagerly awaited the history at high noon presentation from her law firm. Andrew, likewise, carved out time from his responsibility at a legal services nonprofit in Brooklyn. I thought to myself, that's right up his alley, combining history and medicine, he says. He did a really good job of providing context and insights to what we now know about blood pressure, heart disease, and how that knowledge might have impacted American history. Helping people appreciate how the past influences the present is part of the history's museum's core mission. History at High Noon and its companion series, History in Highballs, launched after the pandemic lockdown in spring 2020, enabling staff to provide meaningful programming outside of the museum's physical location, often with presenters who are not typical historians. The streamed events have helped the museum evolve amid challenges, and it has since its founding 122 years ago as the Hall of History. Prior to 2020, people could bring a lunch to the museum for History a la Carte, a popular series that drew mostly Raleigh residents. The broadcasts reimagine those in-person events and expand their scope. The free events, also available on demand, are watched by fans across North Carolina, including folks for whom travel to the state capital is not an option. They also attract viewers from as far away as China, the UK, and Australia. 5 hours ahead of Raleigh in Portugal, a friend of Dr. Sobiero's logged on to watch his session in real time. We've been able to reach more people and have speakers from farther away, says Kara Leinfelder, the museum's creative director. It's expanded our reach in the best possible way. Uncertainty about using new technology is evident in the early broadcasts, like the Montford Hall, Past, Present, and Future episode of History Plus Highballs. Guest speaker Sarah Shepard recalls Can You Hear Me jitters in a glitch that briefly delayed a slideshow tracing the Raleigh Landmark's earliest days through its conversion into Heights House, the boutique hotel that Shepard owns with her husband Jeff. It was exciting and something we'd never done before, Shepard says. We have a lot of guests and who are interested in the history, and we'd love the opportunity to talk about that with them. Perhaps no one fueled audience interest as much as Raleigh actor and director Ira David Wood III, whose June 2020 History and Highballs talk evolved into a contemplation on maintaining one's humanity in a time of crisis. That opened the door for people who normally engaged with in-person communities to lead programs in their areas of expertise. Topics ranging from instilling the Jewish concept of integrity at Meshuggah, a Charlotte Deli to the global impact of hip-hop. While many on-site events have resumed, the museum remains committed to presenting virtual history programs every month. Some are hybrid events with presenters who engage with on-site and online participants. Sandra Gutierrez of Cary was featured at one last October to launch her book, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from 21 Countries of Latin America. She says that the museum's status facilitated a more in-depth conversation than one likely to occur during a typical book signing event. One of the beautiful things about presenting Latin American foodways through history is that it creates an opening to teach about things that are not comfortable and may be problematic, Gutierrez says. Food allows you to present the silver lining in history. It allows you to find that balance and to see what is good for us that maybe didn't start in a good way. Lively Q&A sessions allow attendees the opportunity to connect with experts, some of whom volunteer themselves to present a program. That was the case with Dr. Michael Sobiero, the Associate Program Director for Ambulatory Care at Wake Med's Internal Medicine Residency, whose presentation was originally developed for fellow medical professionals. My dad was a U.S. history teacher, and I've always been interested in history, Sobiero says. Medicine and health have long played a significant role in world and U.S. history. Sobiero's talk explored the medical care, some influenced by now debunked science, some by bald politics, that impacted the lives of three U.S. presidents. He described how physicians attended the ailing George Washington and disagreed on whether he should receive a tracheotomy, not yet a common procedure, or be bled with leeches. The latter prevailed, leaving contemporary scholars to debate his likely preventable death. We've made real strides in evidence-based medicine, but we need to remember our history and what happened, or we may make the same mistakes. During a History Plus Highballs program last December, North Carolina's First Lady, Kristen Cooper, welcomed virtual visitors to the Executive Mansion to see it decorated for the holidays. She appreciates the format's friendly, low-key vibe and the potential to bring museum and historic site resources to North Carolinians who might not otherwise get to experience them. It's a joy to see school children come to the Executive Mansion from a tour, she says, but it's just physically and financially not possible for so many people who would enjoy and benefit from it. The power of virtual programs opened a window that need not be shut down now that pandemic restrictions are no longer in force. Through that endless view, we can witness history, engage with others, and feel our hearts race to the future, all from the comfort of home. To learn more, visit ncmuseumofhistory.org. The Sandwich of Surrey County. In the foothills of North Carolina, the Great Depression gave rise to a simple yet delicious sandwich that can't be found anywhere else in the state. 5 or 6 years ago at Speedy Chef, a little hole-in-the-wall restaurant in Mount Airy, I laid my eyes on a ground steak sandwich for the first time. Frankly, I wasn't sure I wanted to lay my mouth on it. On that day, we, my wife Becky, our youngest daughter Caroline, and I, had sought out Speedy Chef for Caroline's and my formal introduction to the aforementioned ground steak sandwich, a supposed delicacy I'd heard Becky and her late father reminisce about for years. Honestly, the second glance wasn't much better than the first. Fully unwrapped, the sandwich lacked any semblance of appeal. It was basically a mound of loosely ground beef mixed with flour, seasoned with salt and pepper between toasted hamburger buns. We'd driven an hour from our High Point home for this? Oh well, I remember thinking, at least I can wash it down with fries and sweet tea. One tentative bite later, though, I was hooked. And I wasn't even sure why. The otherwise nondescript sandwich was, well, delicious. I glanced over at Caroline, wondering what her picky palate thought of this new find. She was already about 3 bites in, which is more than answered my question. Prior to that day, I had never even seen a ground steak sandwich, much less eaten one. That's gastronomical blasphemy in my wife's native Surrey County, where she grew up eating ground steak cooked by her grandmother's or at one of several eateries around town without realizing that countless North Carolinians, including her future husband, were oblivious to what we were missing out on. Now I consider myself a ground steak connoisseur. After that initial bite, we've made several trips to Mount Airy each year, ostensibly to go shopping downtown, but in reality to satisfy our ground steak cravings. To the uninitiated, ground steak is a mystery you can't solve without trying it for yourself, a loose meat cousin to the hamburger and a less spicy, distant cousin to the sloppy Joe. The whole of this tasty sandwich is greater than the sum of its admittedly ho-hum ingredients, which consist of crumbled ground beef, browned and thickened with flour and water or milk, and then seasoned with salt and pepper. It's most often served on a hamburger bun and topped with coleslaw, onion, and a slice of tomato. That's the all-the-way version, or a slathering of mayo. What's unique about the ground steak sandwich is its hyper-local identity. Not only is Surrey County ground zero for ground steak, dating back to its creation there nearly a century ago, but it's also holy ground because it's the only county in North Carolina where it's served. Go outside Surrey, and you won't find restaurants or many folks that have even heard of it, says Travis Fry, tourism coordinator for the Surrey County Tourism Development Authority, who organized a Surrey ground steak trail last year to highlight local restaurants that serve the sandwich. It's one of our hidden treasures. The ground steak sandwich is believed to have originated in the 1930s at the old Canteen restaurant in downtown Mount Airy. Eventually, it spread to diners and burger joints in nearby Pilot Mountain, Elkin, and Dobson. When the lunch whistle blew at textile mills in Mount Airy, workers would walk to Main Street for sandwiches, and one of those was ground steak, Fry said. It was an affordable sandwich for blue-collar workers. It quickly spread, and people around the county started enjoying ground steak. Even before that, though, many Surrey County families cooked ground steak at home as a way to stretch their beef and make it last longer during the lean days of the Great Depression. A perfect case in point is the late Alpha Collins, whose granddaughter, Gina Erickson, owns and serves ground steak at Cousin Gary's family restaurant in Pallet Mountain, one of the restaurants on the Surrey Ground Steak Trail. My grandmother had 18 children, and making ground steak was a cheaper, easier way to feed her family, Erickson says. When she cooked a meal, she cooked in bulk, and ground steak was something she cooked often. The recipe was handed down to my mom. She owned this restaurant for 30 years, and then it was handed down to me. At Cousin Gary's, you can get a ground steak on a bun or on Texas toast. That's Erickson's preference. Or you can get a ground steak plate with just the meat and a couple of vegetables. When my grandmother made it, they would get it in a bowl, Erickson said. They didn't get it on a fancy bun. They might get pintos and a biscuit with it, or mashed potatoes and a biscuit. When my mom made it, we'd have mashed potatoes and a biscuit with it, but here you can get it however you want it. Another stop on the trail, the Dairy Center in Mount Airy, has been cooking ground steak for 70 years. The sandwich is served many ways, but owner Freddie Hyatt says that some of the most popular offerings are the ground steak and egg sandwiches and ground steak omelets on the breakfast menu. As popular as ground steak is in Surrey County, Hyatt is surprised that it hasn't taken off beyond county lines. We get people from out of town coming in here all the time telling us they were referred here and told to try a ground steak sandwich, he says. They look at you like a deer in headlights and say, "What's a ground steak sandwich?" Hyatt gives them a sample and then offers to fix them a sandwich. "If you don't like it," he jokingly tells them, "I'm going to charge you double." He insists that he's never had to charge a customer double, though, because everyone loves ground steak. For more than a half century, ground steak sandwiches have also been served up every year at Mount Airy's popular Autumn Leaves Festival, courtesy of the Flat Rock Raritan Club. And last year, ground steak got its own celebration, the North Carolina Ground Steak Festival, held in Dobson on the second Saturday of June. The Ruritans serve sandwiches there, too, along with Dobson's Central Cafe, as the town welcomed more than 7,000 people, many of whom tried ground steak for the first time. Mark King, president of the Ruritan, remembers one particular family's introduction to ground steak that day. "The dad bought a sandwich and took a bite, and then he gave his little girl a bite," King says. He still had it in his hands and was about to take another bite, but she wouldn't turn loose of it because it was so good. I laughed and gave him another sandwich. I figured there's no better advertising than that. And we've got a listing here of places that you can get a ground steak sandwich trail. And the cities, we go over that again, the cities that you can find, it's like four or five locations around Mount Airy, three locations it looks like around Pilot Mountain, one in Dobson, one in Rockford, and one in Elkin. So we've got Aunt Bee's Barbecue of Mount Airy, Dairy Center in Mount Airy, Snappy Lunch at Mount Airy, Speedy Chef of Mount Airy, and then also in Mount Airy, there's Martha Sue's. In Pilot Mountain, we've got three restaurants, All Sauced Up Barbecue, Cousin Gary's Family Restaurant, Aunt Bee's Barbecue of Pilot Mountain, and then moving to Dobson, there's Central Cafe and Rockford General Store, and then in Elkin, Speedy Chef of Elkin. Should you need to get a fix with ground beef sandwiches. The next article in Hidden History is Faces from the Past. A home renovation in Edenton reveals a collection of photos that have been lost behind a mantle, some more than a century. Shielded from sunlight since at least the 1920s, the black and white portraits had not faded. An African-American woman stands draped in an elegant floor-length coat trimmed with a fur collar, her head topped with a wide-brimmed dress hat. A dapper-capped man is wrapped in his tight jazz suit jacket, which is adorned with a tie pin and a kerchief in his breast pocket. A mustachioed man in a tweed coat, vest, and high-collared shirt stares directly into the camera. It must have been a special day in the lives of this family. At the time, African-Americans in Edenton, just decades removed from being enslaved, still worked tirelessly as carpenters, bakers, and blacksmiths, fishermen and farmers, and midwives with little time for rest. To have one's picture taken was an honor, a formal occasion not to be taken lightly. So when the photos were developed and returned, they assumed a prominent place in the home, one befitting their dignity, the living room mantle. Then, over time, whether by a brush of a shirt cuff or nudge of a feather duster, the photos fell behind the mantle, not to be seen for 100 years. The white paint on the two-story home at 123 East Gale Street in Edenton had peeled like a bad sunburn. The metal roof had buckled. The screen door no longer fit its frame. But who among us wouldn't look a tad frazzled after 130 years of heat and humidity, hurricanes and tornadoes, and yes, even a freak winter storm in 1927 that buried the town in 26 inches of snow? The home's bones were solid. Robert Price, the formerly enslaved man who built the house around 1886, made sure of that. The sawtooth cornice had all its teeth. The turned porch posts remained strong, and the gable ornament, a miniature steeple that, when the skies were right, seemed to puncture the clouds, still pointed to heaven. Some people might have valued not the house, but rather the land under it. Instead, Down East Preservation sensed possibility. A ton of these houses, for whatever reason, have remained intact, says Burton Swain, co-owner of the company. It's part of what's kept this town so beautiful. The Edenton-based restoration company chose to try and return the Robert Price home to its original architectural splendor. Water had damaged the downstairs of the house, so when the preservationists began to working in the living room, they had to pull the mantle away from the fireplace to repair the plaster in the mantle. It's always fun when you remove a mantle, says Dawson Tyler, the company's founder. That's where you typically find the most interesting thing, because that's where they've fallen behind. There were the photos, not just from the early 20th century, but even later. A Christmas card from what appears to be the 1970s features a girl of about 2 years old carrying a black person wearing a summer dress, white socks, and black Mary Janes. She leans toward the camera, a saucy smile on her face, her brown and white dog panting beside her. The card reads, "Season's greetings, Ruby and Clarence." Putting something up on your mantle is a really special act, says Briley Rasko, the company's chief marketing officer and design center manager. To think that generations of these important people were put up there and slipped behind the cracks, and we were lucky enough to find them. In the 1970s, East Gale Street remained a cultural and religious center for African Americans in Edenton. Just two doors down from the Price home, Kadesh AME Zion Church, which down east is also restoring, served as a refuge for black residents in the late 19th and early 20th century. It's possible that Mary Williams, an evangelist from Norfolk, Virginia, had preached at Kadesh AME. Behind the mantle in the Price home, down east workers found a tattered page from a pamphlet suggesting that Williams may have led congregants in the 1905 hymn, "The Storm is Passing Over." This is living history, Tyler says. You're uncovering something that's been lost to the ages, and it's just incredibly impactful. But who are the people in the family photos? Perhaps property records could reunite the portraits with their families. A deed history of the home reads like the book of Genesis. Joseph Price, who had been enslaved, brought the lot for his son, Robert Price, one of 17 black carpenters in Chowan County at the time of the 1880 census. In 1935, Robert handed down the home to Maria Price, who had bequeathed it to Henry C. Bond. Henry sold the house in 1952 to Norfleet Williams Bonds Sr., who lived there with his wife Rosa for nearly 30 years until his passing. Norfleet was survived by Rosa, their son Norfleet Williams Bonds Jr., and their daughter Christine Fleming, but Norfleet died without a will. Later that year, Norfleet Jr., Christine, and their spouses deeded the house to Rosa. When Rosa died, she bequeathed the house to several family members, including Norfleet Williams Bond III. And when he passed in 2021 at age 89, his wife, Francine, 8 daughters and 3 sons, a sister, a nephew, 21 grandchildren, 27 great-grandchildren, and 5 great-great-grandchildren survived him. Surely, of those 67 living family members, someone could say if the photos belong to them. A funeral home in Concord provided the last known number for Francine. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. An afternoon spent falling down the rabbit hole of genealogy sites turned up several more leads, but none could put a name to the faces. Down East returned the restored mantle to its place of prominence, and finished the Price home in 2020. Now the white paint on the weatherboard is the color of cold milk. The metal roof is tight as a snare drum. On the front porch, adorned with turnpost and gingerbread spandrels, one could relax and bask in the southern sun. Atop the home, the gable ornament, a miniature steeple and a symbol of faith, still points to heaven. I'll go back to the beginning of this article and tell you a little bit about the photos in this. In a twist on the popular idiom, the photos on this page were forgotten over the years, but they were never gone. And there's most of these are vintage photos of people, and they're a little bit tattered and obviously worn. The picture that was described earlier about the elegant coat with the fur collar and a dress hat, there's someone, looks like in a gown that perhaps he's a preacher. I don't know. He's holding a book in his left hand and pointing upward. And then there's a little girl with looking up at the photograph with the puppy dog, and that was described in the piece as well. The restoration of the 130-year-old Price House resulted in an exterior that looks much like it did when Robert Price built it. Work on the interior yielded a similar result, plus a trove of family photos behind the living room's fireplace mantle. And you have a picture of the fireplace mantle in the living room. And you can see over the years where it was definitely used as a fireplace, and there's some darkness up at the top of it. It might indicate some flames or something. And then the picture itself of the house from the front. It's a rather narrow house, But the beautiful woodworking around the post of the porch are, it's really quite beautiful. And then you have a picture, some more gingerbread up near the peak of the house, and then the gable ornament. Excuse me, pardon me for that. Quite a beautiful house. The North Carolina Icon section is about dogwoods. The race to elect a state flower was tight. The pressure was mounting to pick the right candidate, one that would appeal to all North Carolinians. In a state with a diverse landscape, home to more than 3,900 native plant species, there were plenty of options to choose from. By 1941, North Carolina had already declared an official flag, song, and seal. But this was not enough. People demanded floral representation. The flame azalea was a fine selection with its romantic candlelight blooms, but some believed it wasn't ubiquitous enough to earn a statewide title. In 1936, an issue of Flower Grower magazine claimed that the oxeye daisy was the flower of North Carolina. Upon further inspection, the assertion was made by a Massachusetts writer, surely not someone fit to speak on our behalf. At the time, garden clubs favored the goldenrod, but alas, it didn't have the name recognition required to win. At some point, the Venus flytrap was in the running, but it must have been ultimately deemed too aggressive. The North Carolina General Assembly finally decreed that enough was enough. After recognizing the great demand to name a state flower, legislators cited the dogwood as the perfect choice. Sure, it might be a tree, but the blossoms that sprout from its branches come April are, as the General Assembly put it, radiantly beautiful. As with any political figure entering the spotlight, stories of the flower's past came to light. According to Cherokee lore, population of tiny people lived among the wild dogwoods. These woodland residents were said to enjoy drumming and singing, and their melodies could be heard in remote mountain areas where clusters of dogwoods grew. Many Southerners have connected the dogwood to Easter celebrations. Some believe the tree was once large like a great oak and that its wood was used to construct the cross on which Jesus was crucified. God cursed the dogwood for its role in the crucifixion, turning its strong trunk and branches skinny and fragile. But in an act of forgiveness, he blessed the tree with the gift of beautiful cross-shaped flowers. After more than 80 years as our state flower, the dogwood remains an ideal representative. Its beauty has inspired legends and stories, and it's celebrated each year at festivals across the state. The dogwood is forever part of our identity. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.